I was heard on the radio or read in the newspaper, I don't remember where, about a video game, video games, about which I know actually absolutely nothing. That there's a group of people who are making video games that are trying to communicate with people world conditions. They're trying to make video games based on current events because not everybody reads, is basically what they said. And you know, for some young people, like reading isn't really where they're at. This is the way people talk. So they thought maybe they'd try to reach young people where they were, which was through video games. So they've been making this. There was a convention, and they had video games based on genocide and starvation. I mean, you know, very odd, but also you can see where people are going and how they're trying to reach. And one that I heard about more was Darfur, which is in Africa, where there's some really horrific things going on. And you know, as a video game character, you're some young man or young woman trying to get from your refugee village to fill your water cans and then get back to your refugee village without being kidnapped, raped, murdered, or held hostage, or you know, all the things that can happen to you. That's just Darfur. If you go anywhere and read anything, it's really true that the world is actually tearing itself to bits pretty regularly, pretty much all over the place. And then if we thank our lucky stars that we're living in America, where at least it's only a question of gas being $3 a gallon, we get to go see Al Gore's movie, The Inconvenient Truth, which I haven't seen but have only heard about, which of course was playing during that horrible hot spell. And you go in there and see all this extremely convincing evidence for the fact that the climate is changing and the planet's going to boil pretty soon. And you come out of it into 98-degree weather at 9 o'clock at night, and you sort of like, I wonder if this is true or not. And then Swamiji called the other day and asked if I'd seen some other film I don't know about, which predicts instead of it getting hot, it's going to be an ice age. He asked me if I'd heard about the ice age. No, sir, I just heard about the global warming. He said, oh, after global warming, it promotes the ice age. And then, of course, there's the AIDS epidemic in Africa, and you probably read the newspapers more than I do, and even right, even as we speak, Hezbollah and the Israelis are doing their best to see what they can do to blow up the whole world. It's not a very pretty prospect, and I'm sure you didn't come here to be depressed. You know, oh yeah, I love to go to Ananda because I weep out the door and it makes me feel god-awful all week. You know, it's not the way to increase our congregation, and it's not really the service that I want to perform by sharing with you today. But nonetheless, especially what's going on in the Mid East, is cause for enormous concern. Now, as a counterweight to all of this, invariably, you'll find somebody who studied something. When I was, because everybody's always studying something, and the government is always giving people money to spend millions of dollars to come up with common sense answers to things. When I was 19 or 20 years old, and I lived in this area before I moved to Ananda, before I met Swami Kriyananda, I had a temporary job at what was then called Stanford Research Institute, SRI. It was so long ago, I don't know even if it's still there, but I had a typist job. I was just like a temporary agency sent in to type. I was typing a document that was marked top secret, right? And it was some kind of a research project that somebody had done, and this was during the Vietnam era, where they had done a door-to-door survey in Vietnam asking the residents which government they preferred, whether they wanted the communist one or the other one, whatever it was. Now, in the paper that I was typing, the researcher was honest enough to say that there were two problems with the research. One was that a war was going on, so it wasn't always possible to really get an objective sampling, and you couldn't go to all the areas. That was one problem. The second problem was the Vietnamese culture itself, which considered it extremely rude to give someone an answer they didn't want. So the people would respond to the survey by thinking carefully to try to understand what the surveyor wanted the answer to be, and then he would give the answer. So the researcher admitted that these two factors might warp the results a little bit. I mean, what we would do with a Gallup poll about what kind of government they wanted in Vietnam, they forgot to take into account that the people with the guns were not asking. Because the people with the guns were not really interested in this sort of elevated, refined intellectual review. And that was just one ludicrous example that I've remembered all these years. But every so often, people put out reports. You'll see a little report of a little hand pump where this, I saw this one where this guy, you sort of, it's like you kind of go like this on pedals, and you can pump water, and the thing costs $12. And they could put them all over the developing world, and everybody would have fresh water, or these little solar-powered things. Or if we did this, if we spent one day's money on that we spend on the Iraqi war, just on building schools in Palestine, I mean, you can just make it up in any way. And all of those facts are true. Because what they're all saying is, it is not a problem that we don't know what to do. It's not that we don't have the technology or the money. It's that we don't want to do it. That we don't have the consciousness. People want power. People want to be power over others. People want to follow all kinds of ways of living that do not result in a unified best for everyone. And we can stand here and wag our fingers like this. We can do studies. We can do house-to-house surveys. We can do anything we want to do. But eventually, what you're going to come down to is mass consciousness, individual consciousness, and the limits of the ego. Years ago, I remember this group of people was working very hard on a very laudable cause, which is they were determined to end war. And they had a very reasonable plan, which is they would create these little cells of dedicated people, and then they would go out and speak to others, and they would speak to others. It had a lot of energy for a while, and it was a good cause for the people who were involved in it. And I remember a group of those people came to Ananda Village, and they wanted to make a presentation to Swami Kriyananda. Not only is he a powerful man himself, but he commands the respect of thousands, tens of thousands around the world. They thought, rightly so, if they could enlist him, that they would enlist many. Now, their technique, unfortunately, was an unfortunate one from Swami Kriyananda's and our point of view, which was they tried to scare the living daylights out of you. And so they had these beautiful charts, really professionally done, and they were pictures about nuclear bombs. And they showed you, if the bomb hit here, how far it would go, how many people would be vaporized, who would then be incinerated, who would then die in 5 minutes, and then this would happen, and this would happen, and then if you made it through all of that, the radiation sickness, the starvation, it was a very grim picture. And they went on and on with chart after this, and chart, and chart, and chart. And finally, Swami was able to get a word in. And he said, you know, 100 years from now, he said, almost nobody who's living on this planet now is going to be on this planet. They're all going to be in the astral world. He said, whether we dribble out slowly over the next century or all transition in one big moment, he said, when you're in the astral world, it really won't make any difference. Now, what he was responding to, he said, and then he spoke more seriously. He said, Master said that cataclysms will come. Master said that the world will be radically changed by violent means. Economic, social, earth changes, who knows what they're going to be. In the 1950s, in the late 40s, Swamiji has often told us, Master stood, and I can't begin to imitate him, but Swamiji said with a voice that just rang, you know, throughout the room, Master said to the group, you don't know what a terrible cataclysm is coming. Swamiji heard him say that, and it's constantly in his mind. You don't know what terrible cataclysms are coming. 60 years have passed since Master said that. Time is difficult in prophecy. But Master said the world will be completely changed, but will be much more spiritual. He said these are coming not as a punishment, but to awaken people to divine understanding. And as Swamiji put it, now is the time to root yourself in God so that when things become less comfortable for us, we know where to go with our consciousness. So Swami's speaking to these anti-war advocates. He said, it's a laudable cause. He said, but when you increase fear, you're increasing the very consciousness which is causing the problem. He said, fear is the root cause. You can't solve a problem by creating more of it. So that was his first response. But then he said also, he said, what you describe is real. He said, the real suffering will come not to those who die, because they'll be in the astral world. He said, it'll be for those who are left. But then he said, consciousness It's the change of consciousness, because only then will people implement what is right in front of them. And where does consciousness change start? By its very definition, it can't start with people shaking their fingers at one another. You ought to be different. Why don't they? It has to start from an inner awareness of our own relationship to God, which makes us not Pollyannas, not blind, but conscious of a greater force that we have to attune ourselves with. You see, the whole problem is the thought of the ego. And even the simple thought that if we just were different, this world would be different. Not different in relation to God, but if we just got our solar system, our educational system, our political system out there. Swamiji's comment about democracy in the Mideast, it's not so much that he's political about it, but he commented, he said, well, they're all trained to listen to the leaders of their mosques. He said, that's just how they think. You can't just go in and tell them that they should think differently. It's never occurred to them to think differently. It's their whole culture. The man pontificates, and that's what they follow. In other words, you have to take into account the karma that brought people to that situation in the first place. You have to magnetize new consciousness. You can't impose external realities. How do you magnetize new consciousness? By having new consciousness. We don't want war, but you can't get rid of it by frightening people. Because when people get frightened, they make dumb decisions. Swamiji said to me once so simply, he said, when your ego gets involved, you make really terrible decisions. That was after I'd done something really foolish. And I've always laughed at that because I watch, whenever I make a really terrible decision or do something really stupid, it's invariably because somehow that self got in there and started thinking about what it wants and what it wants to do or what it's frightened of, and then it tries to impose. You know, the whole imposition on others invariably comes from fear, doesn't it? Because somehow I have to control this world in order to feel safe. But when we understand and have that relationship with God, which is not a relationship that can be quantified and taught in school, unless we teach it from the point of view, as we do in our school, from self-realization. We don't teach religion in our school. It's so hard to explain to people. We've been using this phrase, universal spirituality, but I at least have suggested that we really can that one. I don't think that's working very well. Because people just think of that then as eclectic. That just means you do a little of this and a little of that, and we do Native American for a while, and then we do African things, and then we were Catholic for a little bit of time, and then we do this. But you're just skating on the surface of a whole bunch of conglomerates. What Master meant by the unity of religion, self-realization has come to unify all religions, he said. Now, it's easy to make that sound like a sectarian statement, isn't it? You know, self-realization, the great megachurch of the future, is going to be the one. That's not what he meant at all. He meant the essence of self-realization, which is the realization of the inner self. That's where the unity comes, whether you're acting that out in relationship to a mosque or a temple or a synagogue or out in nature or wherever you are. It's the realization of the inner self that matters. And once we realize the inner self, we look to one another, and what do we see? We see our very own self. Recently, I saw a movie that was about the Truth and Reconciliation Council in South Africa after Nelson Mandela took over that country. That was a remarkable period of time where there was so much horrible violence in their past. It was just overwhelming to deal with. I think it was because Nelson Mandela had spent all those years in prison that his mind was so clear. He also, I didn't understand this. There's a deep-seated African concept, and they gave the African word in the film, but I don't remember it, which says simply that we are united. We are one with one another. And whatever you do affects me, whatever I do affects you. And anger, revenge, hatred, punishment, it doesn't take you anywhere that you're trying to go. Because it's not the antidote. It's not the antidote to the negativity. The only antidote to the negativity is love. In the Bible, it says it perfectly. All delusion comes from fear. If you think about it, every attachment, every anxiety, every improper exercise of power over someone else comes out of some kind of a fear. If you're completely centered and relaxed in God, you don't act in these ways. In the Bible, it says, perfect love casts out fear. was one of the first profound, genuinely true things I ever learned in my life. I was 19 years old when I heard that. And to this day, it still is an axiom of life that has never run out. Perfect love casts out fear. And so the South Africans started this amnesty where if you completely confessed and were open about what you did, not in all cases, but as they exercised it, if you were following orders and it was political, if you were truly evil and sadistic, you weren't given amnesty because that wouldn't have been wise for society. But those who were caught in the system, black or white, on either side, they were given amnesty if they spoke up and spoke the truth. Because if I forgive, then the fabric of society is strengthened. If I continue to hate, then the fabric of society is weakened. And it's just as simple as that. But everybody does this in their own way. This is slightly off the subject, but there's also some film, and I don't know where it is, I just happened to see it, and it's a film of all these different appearances of Mother Mary in relatively modern times, and filming of many of the mystics who are having these visions of Mary all over the world. Really beautiful, the children in Yugoslavia and others, modern times, they have films of people with Mary coming. And there was this beautiful African girl, and they were filming her, and she was just chatting with the camera, waiting. And then, faster than the camera could catch it, but you were watching it on film, Mary appeared to her, and her entire demeanor completely transformed. And suddenly, she was in another world, just seeing what no one else could see, but there was no question that she was seeing it. But part of what was so beautiful about that is then they had this scene of these African Catholics. And they were doing the same Catholic rituals, but they were doing it in their way. And when Rahm, who's an African-American, who lived in Europe for years, and he and his then-wife, Diana, took a trip to South Africa and to Nigeria. They're the only Kriobans who've ever gone and taught down there. And Rahm has this, he's black-skinned, but he was a white person as far as the Africans were concerned. But he has this remarkable capacity to tune into the cultures that he is, wherever he is. And Diana said later, somehow or another, he sang Door of My Heart, just as Master wrote it, but he gave it an African beat. She said, I don't know how he did it. But when I was watching this film of these African Catholics, they were doing the kind of, you know, that kind of dancing that you see them do like this with that wonderful rhythm and singing. And then in the middle of it, they would go like this. And it was so beautiful to see people take exactly the same thing but make it their own. Now see, that's not being eclectic. That's really being yourself and taking it deep and embracing what it is, but being able to see in the midst of it, you know, both the uniqueness and the universality. It was just so thrilling. That's what real unity of consciousness is about. If we're just shallow in the name of being tolerant, we never penetrate below the ego. You see, that's why eclecticism doesn't work. You must penetrate below the ego. You must get to the point where you are not afraid, where it's not just a question of affirming right attitude, it's actually seeing right attitude. And in that right attitude, you have to relate realistically. I was very touched by this truth in reconciliation because some people, they said, your zeal was greater than was required, and you're going to be punished. You know, you didn't just act from politics, you acted from sadism. And sadism cannot be forgiven. It must be responded to in kind. We can't just be sentimental. Oh, if we just, you know, are so nice, if we were just nice to those Hezbollah people, if we were just nice to those suicide bombers, then maybe they wouldn't do it. You don't understand. They want to do it. They really want to. It's part of their inner reality. You can't solve it just externally. You have to solve it on the level of consciousness. Now, here's the other part of it that must be said. This is God's world. This world does not belong to you and me. We are not here permanently. There will be the moment when we leave this world. And when we are gone, we are gone. It's a remarkable thing to contemplate. You know, if you were on the battlefield of the Civil War, as soon as your soul was finished, you're gone. You're not in the Civil War anymore. You're not on the battlefield. It's just over. It just Every death, which people see so much as this big ending point, there's no ending point. You just spend a time in this body and then you go away. Whether you're old and leave at the end of a long and fruitful life, you just go on to the next thing. It ceases to exist for you. We have no capacity to be responsible for planet Earth. We're just not. We're here, however, with a profound responsibility. And that is to expand our consciousness and our sympathies. You see, one of the ways our consciousness expands is by recognizing that that poor child in Darfur trying to go from the refugee village to the well and back again, that's myself. You remember in Autobiography of a Yogi? Was it Ananda Mahima, Lahiri Mahashaya? I can't remember which. But one of them just cried out, "Oh, I'm being drowned off the coast of Japan." You know, hundreds of people had been in a ferry accident, and this master, thousands of miles away, felt their fear. When Ramakrishna once, somebody in his ashram was mistreated a cat, actually struck a cat with a stick. And then later, that ashramite came to see Ramakrishna. He had welts on his back. "Oh, master," the disciple said, "who did this to you?" Ramakrishna said, "You did." "Sir, how could I have done that?" "When you struck the cat." He said, "You struck me." Now, really, really contemplate that. We are one with everything. We were with Swami Kriyananda once in Disneyland, of all places. He used to really like Disneyland, not anymore. Disneyland used to be very innocent. Walt Disney created an entirely other universe. Now, after he's died, they've amalgamated it with popular culture, and it doesn't have the purity. But in those days, Swamiji really liked it. I'm talking the early 70s. A group of us went to Disneyland, and for some reason, I don't know why, he wore his orange robes. We were down there doing some programs, and we were all wearing Indian clothes in those days. Those were our dress-up clothes, and it was the beginning of all this stuff. So we were all these American kids in saris, and the men had on the pajamas and the long tops, and Swami was in his orange robe. And we spent the day in Disneyland like that. We were a scene, I'll tell you. Swamiji was in the lead, very, very powerful. He was, you know, this was 40 years ago. He was quite strong, and he walked really fast. He knew exactly where he wanted to go, and there was a dozen of us, so he would get out of the car, whatever, the ride first, and he would be off to the next one, and we'd still be unloading. So we were holding hands like this, you know, just running through Disneyland. It was fabulously fun. And at the end of it, they have the electric parade, which is so beautiful. It's like the astral world there. I haven't been there in many years, but... And so we're a big group, so we went early, about an hour early, to get our places on the sidewalk. And I don't know what happened, but the bhav, the inward mood, really shifted. And Swami was just standing there with an extremely far away look in his eyes, and we're looking out at hundreds of people from all different countries, all different ages. You know, it's really a zoo down there, a delightful zoo. And Swami turned to us and he said, "Imagine," he said, "not merely loving these people," he said, "but actually being every one of them. As much as you are yourself, you are them." He said, "This was Master's consciousness." And then there just this sort of silence fell on us. And right in Disneyland, Swamiji just sat down on the sidewalk and started to meditate. And all dozen of us just sat on the sidewalk. We just started to meditate. This extremely deep mood. You see, it's not a question of where you are. It's a question of what your consciousness was. And in that case, the vision of all those souls just put him into an ecstatic state, and he took us with him. For an hour, we sat on the sidewalk meditating. And during that hour, this whole crowd completely filled in around us. We sat down on an empty sidewalk. They filled in around us, and we sat there until the parade was right in front of us. And then somehow that energy brought us out, and we came up. Isn't that unusual? But again, you see, you look around and you see, and what happens is, when you regard the world with those eyes, then you are really changing consciousness. Ananda Mahima, who was always in a very elevated state, was traveling through a jungle area of India, and she got separated from her companion. She was all by herself in an area where there were lots of bandits who regularly killed travelers and took everything that they had. And she's all by herself in this jungle, and she sees this couple there, and she goes up to them with complete innocence. "Father, mother," she says, like this. She said, I'm lost. Can you please take care of me? And they just took care of her. They took her home. They fed her. They gave her money. They escorted her to the next place. Later, when others heard about it, they said, that's a very dangerous forest. You know, anyone who's accosted there alone never comes out alive. And in fact, it was the bandits who had taken care of her. But her consciousness shifted them. You know the story of St. Francis of Assisi, when two unsavory characters came and knocked on the monastery door and wanted to be admitted. And the brothers sent them away. You can't come in here. You're bad people. When Francis heard about it, he sent the monk out. He said, you go find them and you tell them Francis wants you to come back and be his guest. And these were evil men who could easily have murdered the monk. But Francis felt the rejection of anyone as not God's children, whatever the small-mindedness of that monk was, Francis wanted him to understand. He went out and he found them, and the monk begged them to come back and be Francis's guest, and they did. And in the presence of St. Francis, not only did they visit, they stayed. And they transformed their lives completely. Now, coming all the way back to events that we think we can't touch, we are, this world is one unified fabric. Do not think that the meditation that you do here in Palo Alto does not affect the AIDS epidemic in Africa. Believe me, it does. In that same context, when I was talking about Swami and the nuclear war, somebody else came with huge ecology problems, listed out all the disasters that are coming. And they wanted Swami to put the energy of Ananda behind it. And Swami's answer was marvelously interesting. He said, look, he said, if everyone in the world lived the way we do, he said, we wouldn't have any of these problems. These are all problems of consciousness. I consider myself to be intensely politically active because I feel, in urging people to turn to God and not toward external solutions. External solutions are just taking the same deck of cards and just reshuffling it, just giving somebody else power. You send all this money over and you find out that billions of dollars just went into Swiss bank accounts. And it's not that you can't help in those ways, but until we change consciousness, nothing will change. Master has come to change consciousness. He said there will be cataclysms, but he also came to plant this message of self-realization, which we who have been fortunate enough to hear it must with our whole hearts embrace, not for our own sakes only, but because it is the way to ease that suffering. It is the way, eventually, to stop this cycle, insofar as God wants it to be stopped. And at the very least, we prepare ourselves by expanding our sympathies and doing what we do. Even if we meditate only alone in a cave, we do it with an open heart. So those vibrations will go forth into the world. You send out one little ray of light. There's a glorious episode in The Light of Asia, which is the story of the enlightenment of the Buddha. At the end, when the Buddha sits under the Bodhi tree and refuses to get up until enlightenment comes to him, and he faces down Mara, the demon, and everything, and finally his consciousness is completely free. And then the way Edwin Arnold writes it in this beautiful poetic way, that he goes then sort of to all these different places, a fisherman, a housewife, a doctor, a merchant, and each one in that very moment, something comes into their heart, and this upliftment happens to them also. Because one soul realized God, and then that light goes forth, and all those who are capable of receiving it to the extent that they can receive it, it comes to them. If you really want to solve the problems of this world, solve it on the level of consciousness, beginning with yourself. The antidote to the world's problems is love. And that is the love through consciousness and consciousness alone. This is what God is asking of us. This is our privilege. This is our freedom. And then we leave this world behind, and it continues to blow itself to bits. But we become the kinds of souls that in whatever incarnation, whatever planet, whatever realm we're on, in our presence, that love of God is more vivid to all who are there. What greater gift? What greater opportunity? What greater privilege? Ours for the taking.